Welcome to the Center for Science, Technology, and Society podcast. The Social Entrepreneurship Action Research Roundtables, presented by the Global Social Benefit Fellows. The Value of Human Capital and the Power of Scaling.
Social enterprises this past summer and participate in on-site fieldwork within developing countries. In total, it is a nine-month commitment and it consists of both a class in the spring and a class in the fall, as well as our field placements. If anyone has any questions or needs clarifications during the presentation, please don't hesitate to ask. So these topics are extremely relevant to the field of social entrepreneurship, as you will learn through this presentation. For those of you who do not know, social entrepreneurship has many definitions, but for the purpose of these presentation, we have decided to define it as the process of creating innovative solutions to address social needs. And now, each of the fellows will introduce themselves.
Hi, I'm Catherine Duane. I was in Brazil this past summer with Natalie and Miles, working with the enterprise Solar Ear. Solar Ear is working to, well, created a solar-powered hearing aid, and they're distributing to people who can't afford a higher-cost hearing aid. So we went down there and we conducted interviews with people who had received the hearing aid, asked them what the social benefit of it was, how it was improving their lives, and then created a survey so that Solar Ear can then distribute it to people and measure the social benefit and then give it to funders in order to scale into other countries. They're currently in Brazil, China, and Africa, and they're looking to go into Mexico and Canada in the upcoming years.
Hi, everyone. I'm Katrina Van Gass. I'm a marketing major and environmental studies minor. And this past summer, I was in Uganda, Africa, working with three social enterprises, Angaza Design, Kiva, and Solar Sister. But most of our work was with Solar Sister. Solar Sister is a social enterprise that trains local women in rural communities to sell solar-powered lanterns to people who have no access to light or electricity. And my team and I traveled all throughout Uganda to these different locations during training meetings and would interview the Solar Sisters and really assess what was the economic benefit of having the Solar Sister job and then what was the benefit of them using solar lights for themselves and for their families.
And I'm Nikki. I went to Nepal with Lizzie this past summer, and we worked with an organization named Equal Access, and Equal Access delivers critically needed information through radio programs, and they're in over 10 countries right now, and they're very successful. So we were analyzing what makes them successful and what are some of their business and tech opportunities that they could develop. And in the process, we talked to many rural and urban listeners and watched how a new project is implemented in the field. So this is all where we have been, but we're just curious about who's in this room right now. So has anyone here been to Brazil before? Okay, and Uganda? Nice, and Nepal?
Two people.
All right. Okay, well with that, we'll get started.
Okay, so we're going to break it down into three parts. I'm going to talk about acquisition of employees. Katrina's going to handle the development of employees, so how they're trained. And then Nikki is going to finish with the retention of employees, so what kind of benefits are given or incentives to keep employees at the enterprise. And we're going to end with a discussion. So let me begin with what is human capital. So by definition, it's the skills, knowledge, and experience possessed by an individual viewed in terms of their value or cost to an organization. But in basic terms, it's pretty much how much value the people within a company have. And then what is scaling? So for this purpose, in terms of a social enterprise, it is the expansion of an organization in order to increase impact. So these topics are important to our group and we felt worth presenting on because in order for a company to grow and expand its goal and achieve its goals, it needs to have the necessary human capital. So as Dawn Harris wrote in her article, the effects of healthy growth with solid human assets is economies of scale and efficiency of operations. It helps to build reputation with specific communities and can lead to financial sustainability. So taking from that, it is in creating a solid workforce, you can gain a better reputation, and it's an effective method of scaling, and then the end goal is to reach financial sustainability. So there are two types of human capital that exist. The first is generic human capital. So people who have skills, experience, and education that can be applicable to varying industries and multiple firms. And then there is specialized human capital, which is context-specific knowledge. It's knowledge, skills, and connections that can be learned working in a specific industry. And then through working for that company and developing unique strengths and a deep understanding of that company's culture, and then it's through experience that an employee understands and strengthens specific skills for that job. So the recruiting process for these enterprises proves to be very challenging. It is hard because they have to find this specialized human capital. So they need people that can apply their work specifically to context, cultural context, and working environments with limited resources, policies and institutions that are weaker than what they are used to, and people who share values and understandings of the people who developed these enterprises. So they need people who are flexible in these working environments. They're creative. They have strong entrepreneurial drive and energy, strong intrinsic motivation, rapid knowledge, and skill acquisition. So you can understand when an enterprise wishes to expand into new areas, and finding the imperfect employees takes time, because if they want someone to go into a new country, spearhead this development, they're going to need to work with different people in a different cultural context. And so here's an example of Nepal. This is where Nikki was this past summer. And so as she explained to us, that was the only car, and that was only because Nikki and Lizzie had come into that area. So for someone to go into this type of place and have to completely work with the scarce resources, a completely different environment, it's hard. It's hard to find people that are willing to do that. So Katrina, you had a personal experience with this past summer.
Yeah, so I think part of finding this human capital that is able to be so flexible in these settings is tapping into the local people, because they do have these skills and knowledge and are able to connect with people on a natural kind of inherent level because they can relate to everyone on a different level than we would if we were to go over, you know, to Uganda, Nepal, or Brazil. And I found that the regional coordinators at Solar Sister, who were kind of higher up in staff of Solar Sister of the organization, had so much skill and so much talent, and specifically some of them. And one of them, Jane, she was one of the top regional coordinators, and seeing her conduct her training meetings, she had just such an effective way to convey the messages to the Solar Sisters and really had an expertise in business, but also had the interpersonal skills to be able to relate and adapt to the employees. And seeing her given presentation compared to David, who was someone from the US who is at an even higher level in the organization, when he gave a presentation, he was conveying the same message, but the Solar Sisters weren't quite as engaged with him because, you know, he wasn't Ugandan and he wasn't able to talk and joke around like Jane was. So I think that's an example of having the skills but also having the cultural knowledge is really both important.
Yeah, and in my experience with Solar Year this past summer with Natalie and Miles, they had a very specific type of person that they were looking for when they were hiring in the factories. They only hired deaf workers to create these hearing aids because people who are hearing impaired have much better motor skills and better eyesight, actually. And so they were looking for specific people who, in some cases, had received the Solar Ear, other cases chose not to use a hearing aid. But these are some of the examples of just how small the tools were that they were working with and the soldering that they had to do in order to create these hearing aids. And so they were looking for a very specific type of worker. And so Nikki's going to talk more about retention later, but it becomes this concept of them training these workers and this hearing impaired community and empowering them, and then them wanting to go on to do other jobs where they could perhaps get a better salary. So, but Nikki's going to cover more of that later.
Okay, so now we're going to talk about developing the human capital. And from what Catherine said, we know that developing the human capital leads to economies of scale and eventually financial security. So it is very important. And every social enterprise is trying to scale. That's really the ultimate goal, is to reach as many people and spread the impact to as many people as possible with their social good or service. But in order to scale, they also need to be developing their human capital simultaneously, because you have to grow the employees, grow their skills, their knowledge, their expertise, if you also want to grow your company. They really go hand in hand, so it's a really important topic in as to how do these social enterprises develop their human capital and what techniques do they use. So this question is also unique to social enterprises because of the working environment of a social enterprise. I want you guys all to kind of, you know, if you haven't worked with a social enterprise, think about these characteristics of why it makes it so different from maybe a business run in the U.S. So people are located in dispersed countries or dispersed locations all throughout the globe. People are in really remote locations, meaning really rural areas that they might not have any communication internally with the company or externally. It's very limited. There's poor infrastructure in a lot of these places, and procedures and systems are constantly changing because of the fast-paced environment of social enterprises. So an article by Harris that we all read introduced a framework to kind of think about development and training. One is formal training, and the second is informal training. And when I say formal training, I'm referring to standardized systems, procedures, routines that are set in place to enhance the employee's skills. And when I say informal training, I'm talking about more high-touch mentorship and coaching on a more personal level to the employee specific or to a problem that they may see. It's more interaction and able to address problems immediately. So we all had different experiences in working with our enterprises and working with the human capital directly. So we're going to kind of explore why formal training and informal training are effective and not effective. So Nikki, why would formal training be ineffective?
Well, I think it's definitely effective if you're trying to standardize and to scale fast, but for social enterprises, it might not be the best idea all the time, because in social enterprises, employees often take on different roles and they have multiple tasks that are outside of their job description. And so a formal training might not cover that, and it might be ineffective in specific problems that might arise. So it has both a plus and a minus side to it.
Okay, that's very true. Formal training, on the other hand, to counterpoint that, can also be very effective and is really necessary if an enterprise is trying to grow and expand to different countries. And I saw this with Solar Sister. One of their formal standardized procedures is monthly trainings that the regional coordinators would go out and have a standard topic, a standard PowerPoint, and give a presentation that was the same for all the different rural communities that they would go to. And I'm gonna show, if you can go to the next slide, kind of what these different training sessions looked like. So this was in Luera. I think the names are still jumbled right now. But she was, the person standing up is explaining solar light, and they're talking about one of the challenges to overcome for that month. Go to the next one. Okay, this is a different setting. You can see the PowerPoint. Everyone's crowded around. That's Doreen. She would always give the training sessions on a monthly basis. Go to the next one. So this is in Gulu. That's Jane, actually. She's the Solar Sister regional coordinator that I talked about, who was very effective as an employee. And that's David, the other one I mentioned. He's giving the talk. And you can see the PowerPoint and some of the solar lanterns that they were selling in different areas. Next one. And this is You would think this is informal, because, I mean, the atmosphere is informal, but having the system in place, that saves Solar Sister a lot of time. If they were to individualize each PowerPoint for a community's specific needs or a person's specific needs, then that would be very costly, take so much time when they can be using these resources to better develop their business. The next one. And yeah, that's in this beautiful area in Nakaseki. They actually fed us with toke and sweet potatoes and just mass amounts of food. That's Kevin, he went to Uganda with me. He's hovering over the food, getting ready to eat. I think I was out in the farm, like, which is 15 acres, just picking mangoes. These are all the Solar Sister women. So I think that I just found that this was such a necessary procedure. And if if Solar Sister wanted to keep expanding to other countries, they're going to need to come up with more standardized formal trainings, or else they're not going to be able to address everyone's need on an individual basis. And so now I think we should talk about informal training. And this can be very effective in a lot of ways, too, because it allows an employee or a manager to help an employee with more specific problems that arise immediately. And right away, they can be in touch and fix the problem. Because of the fast-natured pace of social entrepreneurship, this is critical. And I saw this in Solar Sister because the CEO is located in the U.S. and, you know, the staff is all in Uganda. And Catherine will communicate with all the staff through Facebook. It's like that's actually her main mode of communication. Even though it's so informal, really important business ideas will be communicated through it, through Facebook chat. I mean, they're always in the office on their Facebook chat. But then also in important, you know, conversational things will be communicated. And it's effective because she knows what's going on. She's able to come with solutions right away. I mean, she knows more than even people who are in the office because she's so in constant communication. But there's also a topic to explore about having this disconnect geographically does create things that are important go unread, misinterpreted, and there isn't a high touch of mentorship because she is not in the country and isn't able to see things that are important on a daily basis. And Catherine, you have an experience you can share.
I had an experience with this in Brazil. So they had, James was a consultant and he was living in Israel, and then they had their Howard, who was like kind of the CEO of Solar Ear, who was living in Canada. So when we were in Brazil, we were doing Skype calls with people in Africa, but then also with Howard and James, who were in Canada and Israel, on different time changes. So we were working around their schedules. But I think what we discussed, at least between all of us, is that the issue with this is that we would be on a Skype call with Howard, something would make complete sense, and then we go to the manager in Brazil, Andrea, and they had a Skype call probably 2 weeks ago, and they were all on different pages. And the problem is that after these Skype calls happen, if you walk away and you're both on two different pages, you're not running into each other in the office. You're not running into each other into each other's offices. So you're only going to get back on that page once you're both having another Skype call. So that's 2 weeks lost in between where two people are working on something in completely different manners. So that was my issue with the informal reality of being in the U.S. or being in different geographic locations than their employees.
Yeah, and one kind of funny story with that was we were at one of the training sessions, and the first one we went to, and Mary, the regional coordinator, was giving a presentation using the PowerPoint, and she didn't even know how to expand a PowerPoint to be, you know, full view on a computer because she was never taught that skill, and you know, no one ever told her. So the woman couldn't even read what was on the PowerPoint. And that just, how would Catherine, the CEO, ever know that, you know, they were never given any presentation skills that might make them more effective leaders, you know, to train the Solar Sisters. So from all this, you can tell that formal and informal training is necessary, and both are really effective if you want the employees to develop, but also if you want to scale your business. And another aspect that we're going to explore now is retaining these skills that the employees are developing? And how, if you have a great employee, how do you retain them? And so Nikki's going to address on that now.
Yeah, so retention. This is really important for an organization. And it's something of a paradox for social enterprises. I mean, usually you assume that the more that you invest in your employees, the more training and development that you give them, the more likely they're going to stay at your organization and continue to contribute at your growth. But in social enterprises, what happens sometimes is because there are low resources already, when you give your employees new skills, new talents, they become attractive to your direct competitors. And your direct competitors say, oh, since you've worked there and you have XYZ skills, come work for us now and we'll give you a better deal. And it becomes difficult to retain your employees, which you have trained and developed with so many of your own resources. So this is what's known as the turnover paradox in social entrepreneurship. And what some enterprises such as eHealthPoint do is they actually train women for their enterprise because women are less attractive to their competitors for employment, which is interesting, but at the same time, I felt like there were other ways to increase incentives, and I'm going to share a story that might help to explain that. So when we were in Nepal with Equal Access, which again produces radio programs to rural and urban listeners to help give them information about things they need to know, like health or government, politics, things like that. When we were there, we met with this team of youth program producers. And so they create a very successful program for Nepal every week. And they do the whole thing from start to finish. They make the script, they produce it in the studio, they make sure that all pieces are really professional, and then they broadcast it. And there's something of a legend in Nepal. About 30% of Nepal listens to this radio program right now on a regular basis. So we got to meet with Ayush and with Kala, and these two people are like the main people on this team, and they were just awesome at doing everything, it felt. And so I told Ayush that, oh, hey, you know, Lizzie and I would like to go visit some of the listeners sometime. So he's like, okay, we can arrange some field visit. And we only really had one weekend to complete this field visit. So we go there, and we realize that all the people that we want to survey, all these college students, actually have exams that day, and they can't participate with us. And we were like, oh shoot, we just took a plane for this. Like, what are we gonna do? We're here. What can we do? And so Ayush just had this. He wasn't panicked at all, like I was, because I'm more of a planner. But he was just like, oh, don't worry. I have some friends. I'm like, what do you mean by friends? And he's just like, okay, just give me like half an hour. And so we give him half an hour, and he's calling people up. And even though we didn't get to meet the people we had planned to meet, we met with local FM station producers, with a blind school, and with rural and urban listeners. And some of these rural listeners were really in the middle of nowhere. I mean, it was like an hour and a half on the bumpiest, most underdeveloped road in Nepal. And I was just like, how can you possibly know people here when you're like from Kathmandu? And, he had really great interpersonal skills, and he helped translate for us, and he was really great with integrating us with these listeners so that we could communicate with them. And it was amazing that he knew so many people. And I was like, talking to him afterwards, and he was telling me that, yeah, you know, he's worked at this organization for so long, but he's actually considering leaving now. And I was like, why? And he was like, well, there's an ongoing joke that the inflation keeps rising, but our salaries do not. And so he was leaving because of the money issue. And that, to me, was a pretty big deal, because the organization seemed not able to retain its employee, but also not to retain all of the things that he brought to the table, like the talent of all of his connections that he's built over time at the organization. There was no database with all of that information that someone could use that again. There was no training for like interpersonal skills, like really how do you talk to these people? And if someone from another culture comes in, how do you integrate them with these people? And so that was a big deal to me. I thought that that should have been harnessed by the organization, but maybe was not going to be. And so some of the literature says that in order to retain employees, you should find people who are aligned with the values and the beliefs of the organization, and then skills can be developed, and you can do that after they're hired. But I found that for this radio program, there were a lot of people interested in this mission anyway, and there were a lot of skills that were valuable. But what seemed to me to be the problem was the problem of incentives. They just couldn't stay because of financial obligations, and that didn't seem right to me. And we've sort of talked in class about this idea of how nonprofits and social enterprises are perceived to be sort of separate from the profit-making world. And an employee in a nonprofit organization who makes a lot of money may not be viewed as favorably. But I was thinking, if these people are really the people to produce change, and if this is what's going to help scale the organization the most, instead of putting money into the programs, why not put the capital and the human capital so that you can actually scale the organization? And that was what I found to be the case, and I found, you know, financial incentives to be very important for the organization. But Katrina found something a little different from that, and so she's going to talk about the opposite case.
So I think financial incentives are very important, but it's also very critical to think about the cultural context of a social enterprise and the employees working there. Because while, you know, in the U.S. we're very success-oriented and like to be paid for our performance and receive monetary, you know, we value monetary bonuses very highly. But in other cultures, that might not be the case. And like in Uganda, there's a little story. Catherine, the CEO, found that, you know, some solar sisters were selling a lot of solar lanterns. Maybe there was a star solar sister selling 10 portable lanterns a month, while the average was usually solar sisters sell around 3. And so she wanted to reward and, you know, really recognize that the solar sister was doing an exceptional job. So she thought she would make this bonus system where they would get a financial bonus if they sold a certain amount of solar lanterns. And so she tried to do this, and she implemented it and found that it created kind of tension among the solar sister teams, and they didn't really like having this competitive environment, and they didn't really find it necessary, because in Uganda they're more community oriented, and you know, they don't want a monetary bonus for selling so many lanterns. That's not really important to them. So she had to, you know, reevaluate. And now what they do is, in maybe a monthly training meeting, they'll recognize a solar sister and just kind of point out to the team, like, this solar sister did really well this month, or even give them like a small prize, like a bracelet or a necklace or something. So it is really important to have financial incentives, and I think for a lot of people in social enterprises, that is what they would like to receive. But when you're working directly with the local employees and you want to reward and motivate them, you need to consider the cultural context.
And just a point further than that, in the literature, it expressed another enterprise that was trying to do a commission-based system. So if someone was doing really well, they were working off commission, and they would be rewarded for their efforts. And they were in a context in which people didn't want, only needed a certain amount of money, and then they didn't feel like they needed to keep working. So they found that there was this issue that the women would get enough money, they would work on commission, but then once they reached that point, they just stopped working because they had enough to pay for their child's school or for health care. And so they no longer were incentivized to keep working. So it's definitely another point just proving that the country's context is, and the cultural context is, vital to knowing how to retain your employees and incentivize them.
Yeah, so we kind of wanted to give you guys like a basis of developing human capital, first acquiring it, then developing it, then retaining it, and why human capital is so important if these social enterprises are trying to scale. And now we're going to kind of go into other special topics of interest that we found while we were researching human capital and just around the broader field of social entrepreneurship. And we really encourage you guys to give us your thoughts and ideas and have really an open kind of discussion atmosphere, because we all have great things to contribute and can learn from each other.
Yeah, so our first topic of discussion goes to retaining employees, I guess. It's part of all three of these sections. But so a lot of donors for nonprofits and for social enterprises will put money into the programs, and they'll be really proud of this, like, oh, you know, 95% of the money that you contribute is going into this specific program, nowhere else. But we found, at least at Equal Access, that this was a little constraining, because oftentimes it wouldn't allow the organization itself to grow, because they couldn't spend it on the people or the management or creativity, or they didn't have contingency funds. It didn't allow the organization to grow. It only allowed the implementation of a specific project. And so this was one of the questions that we had, like, is it okay for a social enterprise to earn a lot of money? Does that mean that there's not a social enterprise anymore? Is it okay for a specific employee at a social enterprise to be financially incentivized for their job? And we wanted to sort of open that up for discussion. Why is there this perception that nonprofits are so different from the profit-seeking world? Yeah, Miles.
Well, if you take a company like Soldier, which is where Catherine went, they can make profit, and what they do is the funds that they make from selling hearing aids can go to reducing the cost of hearing aids for people who cannot afford them. So if a company like Soldier came into a lot of money, they can then reduce the cost or nearly make it infinitesimally small for, like, someone who lived in a rural community to afford a hearing aid. And if, like, by doing our research, it does actually promote the social benefit of these people, they can then return that back and not have them pay as much as they would like to pay. And in some cases, they can make it free.
Yeah.
I think there's kind of like a sense that if you call yourself a social enterprise, then you're geared towards creating a social good in whatever context you're working in. And therefore, any resources that you're not putting towards that end are counterproductive to what you're saying you're doing. And I don't necessarily agree with that whatsoever, especially when we're talking about things like, you know, maintaining the viability of an organization. But I think that a lot of times people look at that and say, you know, why is this person making so much money? Shouldn't he be sacrificing some of his salary, his or her salary, to, you know, further the social good that the business is trying to do? And so it's kind of ironic that you're undermining, people see that you're undermining your own mission by, you know, saving some money for yourself.
That's true. So it seems like direct or indirect cost. Yeah.
Yeah, the other thing that you guys probably were thinking about this weird thing to talk together, but if you guys remember Sam Baker, he came to talk to our whole fellowship class. He was telling us, he works at a nonprofit, I think it's a nonprofit, called Not for Sale, and they basically try to help girls who have been sexually assaulted, and they have all kinds of different programs to basically raise money for it. It's for a really good cause. But Sam was telling us that a lot of times they'll get donations, or previously, I guess, before they change their policy, people would give them money and say, "This, I want it to be for this specific program," and that was really hurting them because they weren't able to do things like buy desks or chairs that they just needed in order to function. So they now only accept money under the, you know, blanket, like, this is for your company. They won't let people tell them how to use their money. And I think that that
and I just felt like working with Sawyer also, It's just how are they going to make the change that they want if they can't even get some of the best businessmen or some of the best employees? Mm-hmm. Because Howard was a consultant and he's living in Israel and he's not directly like getting paid by Solar Ear because they can't afford to hire him. So he's consulting in his free time, but he can't afford to leave his job because, as we asked, he says he's a family, he has a life, he's a certain lifestyle that he can't give up just so he can work for Solar Ear, who can't really afford to give him enough money to provide that type of lifestyle. So it's kind of these contradicting points.
And it sort of encourages competition too, I think, if you have financial incentives, because then more people are likely to maybe apply for the position, which means you're sort of ensuring more quality from your employees, which would help to scale the organization eventually, mm-hmm. As well. So that seems like it's related in that sense.
And I think that there's so much risk that goes into going to the field of social entrepreneurship, but there is so many people who could be of such value, but the risk kind of deters a lot of people. And if there wasn't such a risk, if people knew they had a more financially secure job, then you know social enterprises would be able to impact more people and ultimately be a lot more attractive.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
When you guys were presenting and talking about maintaining human capital in an organization, made me think there's sort of like two different perspectives. You know, on one hand, you've got the organization that's looking at losing human capital, and that's a detriment to their viability. But then on the other hand, if you look from the perspective of the person who now has the skills to be able to go get a better job somewhere else, I mean, is it really that bad of a thing? Excuse me. And so the question is, you're still creating a social good in the sense that you now giving somebody the skills to go on and work somewhere else in another job, and while it might be bad for your organization, what's really the question there? Are you more concerned about your organization and having a social good? So I'm just wondering if you guys have any thoughts on that. I mean, because you talk about scaling and being able to maintain that human capital in terms of being able to scale your organization, but maybe it's just that you are sort of a capital developer, and you have a high turnover of employees because that way you can get more people in and train them with the skills they need to then go out and get another business.
Right. I was thinking about that yesterday when we were looking at this, and I was thinking that, yes, it's helping with employment opportunities, but the thing that happens is often those people who now have those skills go and find, corporate jobs that isn't in development anymore. And that, yes, you're helping employment, but I don't think that every social enterprise has that mission of this is what we're trying to do. So in terms of scaling the actual enterprise's growth, it doesn't help them in the long run to deliver that impact. And let's say it's equal access, if they're delivering information to people which might help them become employed anyway, then it's something that can't be measured very well, but it's an indirect cost, it seems to me. Phil, did you have something?
Yeah, I think your point about the mission of the enterprise really is very important. When you talk about talent leaving for other jobs, so the enterprises I work with over this summer, I worked with Adodeep, which talks a lot about education for the rural areas, as well as iMerit, which employs them in business processing stuff. And they said a decent amount of their students would get employed in iMerit and then would gain the skills and be hired away. But in a sense, they also considered that to be a success, because their whole point of the first half of their enterprise was to educate these people enough to get these jobs. And iMerit was just sort of a stepping stone. Now, obviously, if they start having a lot of their middle management and higher management taken away the same sort of way, that really does hurt scaling. But on a lower level, that was really the whole mission of the enterprise, was to take these people who worked out in 3 hours away from anywhere, any sort of office where they have a career building job that has opportunities, and give them a pathway into this sort of corporate career.
Yeah.
And maybe that's, you know,
able to use it however they want, we're really limiting social enterprise. I expect them to be, like, you know, so incredibly moral that they don't even care about their own sustainability. Mm-hmm. And that's no way to develop countries. So I think that you do have to take your own interests into account, and it's not immoral to do so. It's at the, you know, you want to preserve your own business, but there's a really good reason for that.
Yeah. Those were all really good points.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Should we move on to the
third one?
Yeah.
Sure. So in order to scale, this is the third question, what is more valuable? Is it skills or cultural knowledge? And yes, it is both, but kind of want to talk about why each component is necessary to scale, and what skills bring and what also cultural knowledge brings. Another way to look at this is, you know, as a lot of social entrepreneurships are run by people who aren't from that country and who don't have that cultural knowledge. And a lot of them are run by people in Europe or the US. And do we, as, you know, Westerners going through having the education that we have, do we bring skills that are necessary for a social enterprise to scale? Or is a locally run business, all local employees, would that be more effective in a country? Kind of think about both.
Natalie?
I just have an example. So this past summer, working with Javier, and he started a diabetes clinic in Mexico, and he was telling me an interesting story. The name of the clinic is Clínica del Azúcar, so a sugar clinic, and I guess when he was first starting, he was having trouble getting approvals of how to be called that, like the sugar clinic, so I didn't think it was politically correct or blah, blah, blah. Diabetes, like the sugar disease, like that's what they say they have. And so the initial funders weren't going to give him any money if he kept it as Clínica Azúcar. But he was like, well, if I name it something else, people aren't really going to know what it is, and they're not going to come in to the clinic. So it was like his cultural knowledge of knowing what the Mexican population calls diabetes, and like they've been able to identify with the name of this clinic. And I think that's really, it was just a strong connection that no one else would have known if living in.
It's true.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think there's also something ethnocentric about someone from the U.S. or a Western country saying, we know what's best for you. Mm-hmm. And to not develop a relationship with the culture and understand the cultural knowledge and tap into the cultural knowledge, in some sense you set yourself up for failure by assuming
Yeah, definitely. And from my experience, one of the other enterprises I worked with was Mangaza Design, and they're actually based in Palo Alto, and they designed this solar lantern with this embedded technology where people can pay for light as they need it with a mobile phone through mobile money. And they have no presence in Uganda, so we were taking lanterns and really evaluating whether Uganda would be a good market for them to enter, and whether Solar Sister would be a good distribution channel for them to use. And part of why they needed us and was to see, you know, how does Uganda react, and how do customers react to this lantern? And us giving the trainings to the woman, there was a lot of disconnect because we weren't Ugandan, and there was language barriers, and we weren't able to really fully assess, you know, how customers feel and how people feel about this solar lantern light because of the disconnect. And I think if they did have a presence in Uganda and, you know, had local people working for them, it would be a way more effective business, and they would be able to tell more, you know, if Uganda was a good market for them to enter.
Yeah, I have an anecdote too about a time in Nepal when I sort of didn't realize why they did something the way they did. And so Equal Access has many programs, and this one program, the youth program, isn't called Equal Access at all. They don't say it in the radio program. They don't write it anywhere. They just call it SSMK, which stands for like something in their language, basically chatting with my best friend in Nepali. It stands for SSMK. And so I was like, oh, well, why don't you keep it with the brand? I mean, this brand is universally, like, worldwide. It's people know equal access. Like, why don't you associate it with that? And they were like, if we associate it to an international organization, we say that we're the youth of Nepal speaking for the youth of Nepal, they're not going to believe us. And they're not going to really listen to us or take what we have for what it's worth. And that was very interesting to me because I was coming from an American culture, I guess, where, you know, in marketing classes, you learn how important branding is. And I was like, oh, okay, well, that doesn't work in this culture. So that was an important realization. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I guess, yes, that's the debate that we had was what matters more? Can you gain the skills later after you, once you live there and you can be taught the skills? Or do you have to have the skills and you can learn about the country afterward? And for us, at least going into Brazil, we were creating the survey and the step-by-step creating each question. And there were certain things the first week we got there were so different than the U.S. and we constructed like a preliminary survey to pilot and we were changing everything just based on the cultural context because the income question, men were living with their parents until they were 30 in Sao Paulo because it's so expensive. And that to us was shocking, but that's just the way it was done there. So I think, at least in my opinion, you can go in with the skills, but I agree, you need to be completely aware that you're absorbing the cultural context around you and absorbing all the information that they're providing.
Yeah.
I also think that like the cultural context is something that you need to set up like primarily and sort of going off of what you were saying. It's like your cultural, having an understanding of the cultural context informs what skills you're going to use and how you like it sort of formulates that. So I think it's a one-two punch. And like how you were saying that it is, they're both necessary. I think one definitely.
Which one do you think comes before?
Cultural knowledge.
I would
agree with that as well. Just because I think when you're sitting here, and we're sitting here now, we can talk about the skills that we have, but I think once you know that cultural knowledge, you'll know which skills to apply in which departments and kind of angle your skills in the right way to reach the success that you're going to get when you get there. Because like you were saying, we sat here, like, spring quarter, we sat with the skills and knowledge ready to go into health-affiliated social enterprise with the sociological skills that we possessed by researching and by doing things in Santa Clara. And we got there, we realized our survey was completely not ready for what we had. I can't even explain what had to be changed in order to make the survey itself or monetary evaluation tool culturally acceptable, because as you said, like, income's completely different. Like, where we could say, like, well, what's your average income, and we can look at, you know, if $50,000 is the cutoff mark, that's what we wanted to look at. From a Brazilian standpoint, how much their income really depended on where we were, because if you sat in Sao Paulo, one street, the income could be, like, they're very wealthy, or they own nice cars, and then the street after that, they're not wealthy at all, they don't even own a car, and there's six people living in one house. And if we bring that survey into a city like Sao Paulo, you're going to get different answers for different questions. And you know, you can't have it like, well, you can't have it in dollar increments, you have to kind of group it in increments. And having that culture knowledge for the time that we were there was really key in order to make this tool, you know, useful for solar here in Brazil. And Solar wants to scale and they want to expand. So when they take a tool that we have created and want to move that into Mexico, it's going to be completely different. There's going to be a lot of different things that they're going to have to ask. I mean, although they have like a molding foundation, which is what we're trying to give them, when they transfer that, it's going to be really difficult to just, you know, give them the same exact tool and expect it to have the same progress as it had in Brazil.
Great point.
That's a good point, yeah.
So now shifting to a different topic, it's not up there on the slides, but how do we overcome this challenge of retaining human capital in rural areas? Because a lot of social enterprises, you know, they're trying to scale and reach the people who need the social good or service the most. And poverty is the most widespread and severe in rural locations that are really hard to get to. So if social enterprises have the goal of reaching these people, how are they going to get human capital to be there and live there and work there under, you know, poor living conditions? It's not an appealing place to live for most people. How are they going to retain this human capital in a really remote and like rural location? I think just we saw that a lot of social enterprises struggle with this, and because a lot of people do want to work in more of the cities, and it's hard to get people who are qualified and who have the skills to live in these remote areas for a long period of time. Remember at GSBI, when all the entrepreneurs were here at Santa Clara, one of them, Literacy Bridge, they're based in Ghana, he talked about how, you know, yeah, this sounds all good, but it's so hard. You know, yeah, you want to work for social enterprises, but it's so hard to get someone to live here. It's really hard to find someone who's willing to really do the work, but also has the skill. Yeah, it's very important. And yeah, we definitely saw that. But what if, you know, some of these rural, remote locations, they don't really have the education or might not have the qualified capital that is from there to do the job? So that's when it becomes more of a challenge. Yeah.
And that helps with sustainability as well, because now Jane can maybe go to another community, make another pipeline there, and something like that. Or mm-hmm. it's easy to scale or to be sustainable, at least. So.
Yeah, we definitely saw that with Solar Sister Jane. There was actually other entrepreneurs that that were with under Jane's leadership, and the company was thinking about maybe moving them up in the future, and then, you know, Jane can maybe even have a higher position. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thanks, Lauren. Lauren? Oh.
Yeah, so I actually, we saw the kind of opposite problem in India this summer, in that, given the cultural context in India, rural women want to stay in their village areas because of the tight-knit family community. Mm-hmm. So there's a critical need for income-earning opportunities, and a lot of people do pursue that and go to the cities where the jobs and like business process outsourcing really are, like the tech industry. But that there's a lot of fear in that a lot of the rural people
don't know what it's like to work in an office. And so while on UDEEP and IMRI address that through a workplace readiness curriculum, so like teaching people in rural areas, this is what an office looks like, this is an elevator, things like that, in order to give them that opportunity, they started a program called DREAM, which is developing rural entrepreneurs through adoption and mentoring, so that they teach people how to set up their own enterprises in the village so that they can stay with their family. So while giving people kind of that channel to go to the cities if they need to, they're also giving them an opportunity to kind of stop urban migration and maybe set up like a tailoring shop in their own community, or they're seeing people start with their own mini cyber cafes, minus the cafe part, like just a computer in a garage type of location, and that's the only internet access for sometimes the whole village, so people will pay this person to check email or to print something, to print their voter ID picture so people can start voting. It's really interesting. So it's kind of a different problem, but Anya's addressing it in a really cool way.
Interesting.
And yeah, just to end with like more relatable situation, Katrina and I guess really, well, we all really resonated with this topic because as we sat down, we ended up sitting for an extra hour just talking about, okay, so what are we all going to do with our lives next? And so Katrina and I are both saying, okay, if we want to do social entrepreneurship, what, we have to be broke? Like we have to give up the lifestyle we're living? And I guess our question was just like, can it go hand in hand? Can we continue to try to make the world a better place or go to and work somewhere, but do we have to sacrifice the lifestyle that we live right now? Do you have to sacrifice a salary? And so, yeah, that was just something that we talked about on a more relatable level. But if any of you guys have anything to say about that, you're welcome to. But does anyone have questions? Or?
Well, does anyone feel maybe they would be more likely to work in development if there was the financial stability with it? Yeah. Same. Interesting.
Does anyone think that you can work in development and also have somewhat of financial stability?
Somewhat.
Yes. Kind of. Yeah.
I mean, I think it's all relative, right? So when we were in India, one of the there's a fellows, Clinton fellows who works with Anandip and IMRI, and they got salary of, I believe, about $400 to $500 a month, which was plenty for India. It's all you needed. They were able to take care of their housing, as well as food and basic amenities, and have like a little extra on top of that. But then the problem is, so he went out and he did this year-long fellowship in India, and he got paid a reasonable salary. He was making more than most of the workers at the company. But then he comes back to the U.S., and really all he has is savings from college. he wasn't able. I mean, rent here is like what, $600 for the worst possible apartment. there's just so many congruencies that don't match.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think cultural context at the end is quite important.
Yes.
I was just going to add to that, Phil. I think it's important to consider too that even if someone can afford to live in a frontier market on a very low salary, if they're not saving for their retirement or for their children's education, it may be hard for them to meet multiple motivations that they have in their life. And so when you think about work-life balance, it's more than just yourself, it's also what you're trying to do with your whole life. And if you have children and want to put them through college and you don't have a way to save for them because you're accepting a $400 a month salary, it's going to be hard to get the most talented people to stay in social enterprise or development for the long term.
Mm-hmm. I think we have seen working with a lot of social enterprises that for a lot of employees, it becomes a very big part of their life. Their work is their life just because you do have to put so much time towards it because it is a new field and it is constantly growing. So I think we are at the time. Thank you guys all so much for coming out.
The Center for Science, Technology, and Society, accelerating global innovation-based entrepreneurship in service to humanity.
For more information on the center, visit www.scu.edu/social benefit.